Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
President Trump yesterday making good on a major campaign promise to reverse Barack Obama's signature foreign policy achievement. It's the latest in Trump's America First policy. But what now? Israel and Saudi Arabia are applauding. European allies are furious. This hour on Point, reaction from Washington and around the world to Trump's decision to exit the Iran nuclear deal. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of President Trump's decision here? Is it the right move? Is it dangerous? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll read the political tea leaves of yesterday's primaries in key Trump states. But first, the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Joining me now via Skype from Washington is Robin Wright, longtime journalist who's covered the region extensively. She's now a joint fellow at the Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's also a contributing writer at The New Yorker, and you can find a link to her latest piece headlined, Trump Destroys the Iran Deal, and a lot more at our website, onpointradio.org. Robin Wright, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Great to be with you.
So let's talk about the consequence of this major decision. First of all, what's the U.S. giving up by walking out of this agreement?
Well, the United States puts itself in a position that it's actually in conflict with many of its key allies in Europe over what, how to deal with Iran, whether it's its nuclear program or the wider array of issues, including its missile development, its behavior meddling in the wider Middle East, and support for extremist movements. So it limits the kind of cooperation we had built up, an international agreement with the world's five other major powers, including Russia and China, to deal with these the broader array of issues. It also, if the deal ultimately collapses, and it has not yet, it will make inspections of Iran's nuclear program very difficult, if not impossible. The accord now has imposed the toughest inspections and verification regime ever imposed in an arms deal, which allows weapons inspectors from the United Nations as well as monitoring cameras to look at Iran's facilities. So it puts us in a kind of twilight zone of what we can do when it comes to dealing with the Islamic Republic.
Now, Robin, you use the term if it collapses, and I'm intrigued about that choice of words and wanted to ask you about it. So the U.S., so Trump wants to take the U.S. out of the deal, but as you suggested, three European countries, France, Germany, the U.K., as well as China and Russia, have all signed on to this agreement. Can this deal survive without the U.S.?
Well, much of it will depend also on what the Iranians do. And so far, the Iranians have indicated that they may stick to the original agreement, which limits their nuclear activities on many fronts over varying periods of time. If Iran should walk away from it, which they had threatened earlier, then the deal does collapse. But at the moment, the big question is, can the other five major powers and Iran sustain the deal? The question for Iran will ultimately be, will they receive the benefits? In other words, the deal was always about Iran limiting its nuclear activities in exchange for the lifting of punitive international sanctions. And the Trump administration is reimposing sanctions, not only on Iran, but on companies and other countries that do business with Iran. But the rest of the world may not. The question is, will other companies and other countries want to do deals with Iran if they feel they're vulnerable to sanctions by the United States, which is the more important business interlocutor or business community for them. So if Iran no longer gets the benefits, then there will certainly be pressure by hardliners in Iran to walk away from the deal because they're not getting any of the benefits.
Robin, I'd love you to respond to sort of the central justification that the president offered in walking out of this deal. I mean, and I guess it breaks down into two parts. First, there were issues around the scope of the inspections, future tests of ICBM missiles, and the so-called sunset clauses. That is, a big part of this deal would actually come to an end after several years. There were concerns about that. There are also concerns about, despite the treaty, Iran was supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria, was expanding its influence in Iraq, supporting terror groups and cyber attacks against the West. So Trump's rationale, by abandoning this agreement, Trump can put pressure on Iran to change its behavior.
Well, there are legitimate concerns about the limits of the deal. It's not perfect. Diplomacy always involves compromises, and that's true of arms deals with whether the Soviet Union or, you know, other adversaries. We often do things that we don't achieve every one of our goals, but we do get a deal that at least achieves big parts of them. And there are legitimate concerns about Iran's missile program. That's not part of the deal at the moment. On the issue of the sunset clauses, you can look at it from two different perspectives. There are deadlines, dates, by which Iran can resume enrichment of uranium, a process that can be used for either a nuclear weapon or for peaceful nuclear energy. And there are other things, whether it's access to mining material and so forth, that over time are lifted. But in different places in the accord itself, Iran agrees never to develop a nuclear weapon. And so it depends on how you want to interpret it. Do you believe that Iran will ultimately honor its long-term commitment? Or do you believe that they will, the minute those deadlines are lifted, go back to resuming development that designed to create a nuclear weapon? The Iranians claim that they never wanted a nuclear weapon. Most people don't believe them. I think the whole diplomacy was about not believing that Iran didn't have some kind of interest in a nuclear capability, whether to develop and test a bomb is another thing, but to develop a nuclear capability that would get them within months of being able to have the world's deadliest weapon. So there are legitimate concerns, but one of the interesting things is that since January, the Europeans have been working very closely with the State Department, the head of policy planning, to develop compromises that would deal with issues in the accord, but also this wider array of subjects, the missile program, Iran's meddling in, as you point out, in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon, in cyber, that have been of deep concern dating back to the 1979 revolution. And they came very close to an agreement that would be just between the Europeans and the United States, would not involve changing the deal, but would in ways be another layer to the agreement that was the U.S. and European interpretation. Chinese and Russians would not buy into it. The U.N. would not have to change its unanimous endorsement in a resolution of the deal. But it would put Iran on notice that the West was going to hold it accountable on bigger issues. But in the end, the Trump administration opted not to go along with the European effort because of this issue, largely of the sunset clauses or the time limits on Iran's program.
Right. I'm talking to Robin Wright, contributing writer for The New Yorker. And let me introduce from Washington, Richard Goldberg, a senior advisor to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he focuses on Iran and other Middle Eastern countries. From 2004 to 2014, Richard Goldberg was the deputy chief of staff and senior foreign policy advisor to former Illinois Republican U.S. Senator Mark Kirk and one of the leading Republican architects of congressional sanctions targeting Iran and its economy. Richard Goldberg, welcome to On Points. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So give me your thought on this. Was President Trump right to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal? And if so, why?
Well, I think in the end he had no choice. I'm actually very surprised that given his rhetoric and views towards the deal, he spent a year and a half still in the deal. He deserves a little bit of credit for actually pursuing both several months of trying to see if he could live with the deal, understanding the policy faults with it, then trying to pursue a diplomatic effort with the Europeans to see if he could find a way to fix the deal. And I think what he finally came up against was the fact that you couldn't fix the deal. The issues involved here go back to the fundamental way in which the deal was negotiated. All of the sanctions regime that we had built up over time, especially between 2010 and 2013, when we changed the way we did our sanctions to apply to banks and companies around the world in a way where we leveraged the entire U.S. financial system against a bank to say, you have to choose between doing business in America or doing business in Iran. We had really gotten the regime towards the brink of a balance of payments crisis because of the way we had locked down their foreign exchange reserves overseas and sanctioned the central bank and were driving down their oil revenues from their exports. And right at that moment, the Iranians wanted, obviously, to get to the table. They wanted a deal. Even President Obama credited those sanctions with bringing them to the table. And rather than using all that leverage at that point to deal with all of Iran's malign activities, including its nuclear program, we ended up cutting a deal that really wasn't good for the United States or our allies. And if you go back to that time...
But wait, let me just stop you there. I mean, wasn't good for the United States. I mean, what about concerns that were pulling out of a deal that kept Iran's nuclear ambitions in check for at least several years, replacing it with a possibility that Iran could develop a bomb within a few months?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the French were very much against this deal inside the negotiations. They were pushing back, and they thought that John Kerry basically gave away the store, which he did in the negotiations. They were concerned about all the different issues that had been raised in the fix talks with the Europeans, whether it's sunsets, missiles, inspections, but also other malign activities that weren't even covered by the deal.
Right. Okay, Richard Goldberg, stand by. We're coming up against a break, and Robin Wright will return to you as well. We're discussing President Trump's decision yesterday to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal. You can join the conversation. Is the U.S. go-alone approach damaging its relationships with key European allies? Or was this a good decision to get out of a bad deal? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. You can join the conversation after this and the earlier withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Does the U.S. now have a credibility problem? What's the message heading into the talks with North Korea? I'm talking with Robin Wright, contributing writer for The New Yorker and a fellow at the Wilson Center in the U.S. Institute of Peace, and with Richard Goldberg from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He was one of the leading Republican architects of Iran sanctions and a senior foreign policy advisor to then U.S. Senator Mark Kirk from 2004 to 2014. And Richard Goldberg, let me come back to you because the break sort of cut you off there. But let me try to summarize what I think I hear you saying. I mean, in terms of putting economic pressure on Iran, I mean, do you see this decision by President Trump as a kind of Cold War strategy that Ronald Reagan employed against the USSR, putting pressure on Iran to choose between economic collapse or negotiating over its bad behavior in the region? Is that fair?
I think that's exactly what this is. I think that people have been asking for a long time, what is the plan B? I think you've just answered what the plan B is. It's a three-pillar approach, which is a very similar strategy to the Reagan administration towards the Soviet Union. You conduct political warfare, ideological warfare. You heard some of those remarks in his speech, really directing at the legitimacy of the regime and speaking to the people to divide them. You conduct economic warfare and try to exert as much economic pressure as you can. And then as well, you strengthen your military deterrence. You coordinate with your allies in the region. You ensure that the Iranians know that any attempt to race to a bomb will be met with consequences they won't like.
So let's listen to a little bit of President Trump yesterday with harsh words for the Iran nuclear deal during his announcement at the White House.
The fact is, this was a horrible one-sided deal that should have never, ever been made. It didn't bring calm, it didn't bring peace, and it never will.
Robin Wright, respond to this idea that Richard Goldberg brought up, or that I suggested, and he sort of confirmed there that this is the kind of approach that worked during the Cold War.
Well, remember at the time that the United States spoke on behalf of the Western world and that pitted us against our leading adversary. At the moment, we're finding that our allies are taking a stunningly different approach to dealing with Iran. They want to stay in the deal, as ironically do the Russians and the Chinese. And so we don't have the kind of unity of purpose or goals that we did in confronting the Soviet Union. I'm also not sure that Iran is the same kind of threat to the United States today, even though it clearly is a threat, that the Soviet Union was during the decades-long Cold War. I do think it's true that the United States has never gotten over the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in 1979, and that phenomena that produced the yellow ribbon as a national symbol when 52 Americans were held 444 days. I covered that crisis and stood at the foot of the steps of the plane in Algiers when they flew to freedom. I think we've never gotten over that kind of psychosis, our deep phobia about anything Iranian. But it's a different kind of threat today than the Soviet Union. The Iranians don't have a bomb yet. The Soviet Union had a huge arsenal. It was our main adversary.
And Robin, I take your point, and I want to sort of put that to Richard Goldberg. I mean, Richard, Robin is talking about a pretty powerful Western alliance that confronted the Soviet Union, where the Western allies were really in lockstep, and that was indeed true from the end of World War II, right up to the end of the Cold War. Now the U.S. is really isolated. I mean, I'm trying to think of a time in history where the U.S. going alone has been able to bring about a kind of positive resolution to a crisis like this.
Well, first of all, I don't think that we are isolated. I think that we have a transatlantic dispute. Our traditional allies in Europe disagree with the president's approach. Our traditional allies in the Middle East very much support his approach and disagreed with the deal to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I think we discount those allies and only really talk about the allies in Europe. But even that said, there's obviously a reason why the European allies are speaking out and were opposed to certain areas that the supplemental agreement was being negotiated with the State Department. There are commercial interests at stake for them now. They want to defend those interests. They have very large companies that have a lot of sway internally that were given an open door to trade and investment. And given the combination of those interests combined with President Trump's approval ratings in their countries, it would domestically, politically be ridiculous for them to support his move here. I understand that. I think in the end, though, they have to remind themselves that we are NATO allies. We are the democracies. We may disagree on the foreign policy approach here. But in the end, Iran is the leading state sponsor of terrorism. They are not a democracy. They are not a member of NATO. They're nothing close to that. They are not our allies. We are allies. And I'll just remind as well, of going back to the Cold War analogy, you know, people forget this. We sort of celebrate and remember the Reagan years bipartisanly with heroism today. But back then, his foreign policy was controversial when he took office. His statements during the campaign were feared by many in the foreign policy community. He had moved the United States away from detente into a policy beyond just containment, into a true victory. And this idea of his three-legged attack, while still talking to the Soviets, while still negotiating with them, even doing arms deals with them, arms control agreements with them, he still called them out for what they were. That was controversial at the time. You know, we look back on it saying, wow, it worked. But that was just as controversial as saying, you know what, the JCPOA is akin to detente. We want to move away from that and more towards the Reagan strategy.
JCPOA, of course, being the Iran nuclear deal. It's worth pointing out, though, which Robin Wright did, that Soviet Union, a very different kind of threat than Iran. But Richard Goldberg, I take your point. I want to get to some callers. Tom is calling from Detroit. Tom, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Anthony. My whole thing in terms of looking at this is just nothing but a continuance of Trump's disdain for President Obama and wanting to wipe out his legacy. And I mean, as you said, I mean, we are more and more alienating, you know, those countries that used to be our allies. And I mean, the bottom line is, you know, we can't do this alone. You know, you've got to have some kind of support from the people. And, I mean, to continue with sanctions, I mean, my God, you know, what are you going to do? Starve the people to death? I mean, come on, let's go ahead and get real here.
Tom, I appreciate your point of view, and we're going to take that on board. I want to go to another Tom who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I think the media is missing the point of this. I think the essence of Trump's removal of the U.S. from this deal is trying to drag the other co-signatories of the deal with him. And the only way he can do that is to compel them to respect the U.S. sanctions. So I feel like this is the $64 million question, which I'll ask you. Will Europe be bullied? Because, you know, Russia and China, they're rogue nations. They won't, you know, they may or may not respect what the U.S. wants them to do. But Europe, who says that they want to respect this deal, will they be bullied by our president into doing this?
I think it's a great question. Robin Wright, what do you think?
Well, the Europeans actually have the option of saying, you know, standing up to U.S. sanctions and threatening to sanction U.S. companies in return. I doubt they'll do that, but it's certainly an option. Well, the thing that is so striking about the split with our allies is that it challenges the fundamental basis of the transatlantic alliance, which was built in the aftermath of World War II and has been the foundation of the strongest alliance in global history. And the stunning statement from the Prime Minister of Britain, the Chancellor of Germany, and the President of France, saying they really regretted the President Trump's decision. And, you know, whatever you think is right, it's always stronger to speak in unison with our Western allies, as we have on so many other issues. And I think that ultimately weakens the United States. And the one of the questions, and it'd be interesting to put to Richard, is, yes, you put the squeeze on Iran economically, but this also comes at a financial cost to the United States. The Iranians had bought dozens of Boeing aircraft, which contributed to, according to Boeing, thousands of jobs and, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. So we end up as an economy paying a price for the very things that President Trump has vowed to create.
Interesting. What do you think, Richard?
Well, to that point specifically, and then I'd love to go back to a couple of the points the callers raised. I mean, we have moral distinctions in how we do business. We have that prerogative as a democracy with basic values. We wouldn't allow Boeing to sell airplanes to Nazi Germany. We just would. That would just not be our core values. We wouldn't do it with North Korea. We wouldn't do it in places where they're sponsoring terrorism. And the money that they make off of some deals and what they use these airplanes for are really horrific. In the case of the airline industry of Iran, we know that they use a lot of their planes to ferry arms into Syria to rearm the Assad regime and Hezbollah. So, you know, we have to make a little bit of a line in the sand and say it's not okay for U.S. businesses to do certain things with certain regimes. That's just the cost of being a world leader, a superpower that leads the free world.
Richard, before you go back to the earlier points, I want to introduce another voice into this conversation, because our caller, Tom, raised the question about, I mean, the way he put it, are our European allies going to be bullied by the president's decision? So let me introduce from Europe. Joining me from Belgium is David Herzenhorn. He's chief Brussels correspondent for Politico Europe. You can find a link to his piece, headline Trump Move Against Iran Nuclear Deal Would Isolate U.S., at our website, onpointradio.org. And David Herzenhorn, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So let me get a quick reaction from you, and maybe you can chime in on our caller Tom's question. How's Europe going to respond to this? What are you hearing?
Well, officials in Europe are vowing to preserve the Iran deal. They recognize that that's going to be extremely difficult. And here in Brussels, officials in the European Union are scrambling to put together what they know is a limited array of policy options. But there are some aimed at both blocking the impact of renewed sanctions on European companies and also finding ways to convince and cajole Tehran into remaining a part of the agreement, which, of course, the Trump withdrawal would give them every right under the letter of the agreement to pull out of. But again, it's a limited array of options, and they know, you know, it will not be easy given, obviously, the muscle the U.S. has financially in the world.
And David, is there a sense that this might be salvageable with another deal, with another set of negotiations? I mean, President Trump has long talked about getting a better deal. It's not exactly clear what that would entail, but how do the Europeans respond to that?
It's really seen as a long shot, and you know, it's not clear to any of the Europeans that there was anything they could have done to change Trump's mind. Many are viewing this as Trump not thinking about the global national security implications, but primarily about undoing the signature foreign policy achievement of his predecessor, about keeping a campaign promise. There's a lot of talk here about what this does to U.S. credibility and to you know, the role of international agreements. I mean, it was the U.S. that signed on to this agreement, not Barack Obama personally, and it's the U.S. that now pulls out in the middle of the game, leaving European companies especially that have gone back to Iran, made investments, believing that this was actually accepted international law, and now he's acted unilaterally to undo that. And so the questions you were talking about earlier are the questions that are being asked here. How in the world does he expect Pyongyang, the North Koreans, to enter into any agreement with the United States when he's now made clear that from one administration to the next, the United States is prepared to tear up agreements on precisely the exact same topic, nuclear nonproliferation?
Let's get a couple more callers into the conversation. Caroline is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Go ahead, Caroline. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm actually finding the turn of events not only surreal but unsettling. I'd like the panel to address this issue of Saudi Arabia and its pernicious role in the region. It's essentially waging war on several countries in the region with the help of the United States, which will, in fact, make the region more susceptible to terrorism, proxy wars. So it's a larger problem than we imagine. And I can recall back to 2003 when we started talking about going into Iraq. Iran was making the same argument and has continued to do so, that Iran is the real threat. So it seems to me that the United States is taking the side of Saudi Arabia in this larger regional sectarian war that can have nothing but awful consequences.
All right, Caroline, well, let me put that to our panel. Saudi Arabia, of course, a close ally to the U.S., an ally that was in favor of President Trump's decision. Robin Wright, let me come to you first of all to answer Caroline's question.
Well, it's a good question, and clearly the Trump administration has taken strong sides with both Saudi Arabia and Israel in both of their concerns about Iran's aggression in the region. But you're right to point out that Saudi Arabia has also been aggressive in the region, and whether it's waging war on Yemen, launching a blockade by land, sea, and air of its tiny neighbor in Qatar, orchestrating the kind of forced resignation of the prime minister of Lebanon last year. And so it has ambitions in the region, too. It's very striking that the crown prince, who is the major power in Saudi Arabia these days, Mohammed bin Salman, has said that if Iran goes back to developing a nuclear capability, nuclear program, a nuclear bomb, that Saudi Arabia will also seek a nuclear arm. And so that's one of the kind of subtext, one of the rippling effects is the growing concern that there will be an arms race if Iran does, in the end, opt to walk away from the deal and go back to enriching uranium and doing things that would contribute to a nuclear weapon. It's a big concern about the growing hostilities, not just involving the Saudi Arabia, but also between, for example, Syria or Iran and Israel playing out in Syria. Yesterday, Israel bombed a facility near the capital in Damascus, and Israel is engaged in a number, more than 100 airstrikes against Iranian or Hezbollah targets based in Syria. And so they're deepening concern that the atmospherics, the climate in the region generally deteriorates.
Got it. Robin, we're coming up against a break. Richard Goldberg, we're going to be letting you go. I wanted to just get a last thought from you in about the 10 seconds or so that remains before we say goodbye.
Yeah, I would just say the era of appeasement is over. We've unshackled ourselves to push back on Iran. And I would hope that Europe reminds itself one day that we're all democracies. Iran's not your ally. The United States is.
All right. Richard Goldberg, senior advisor who specializes in Iran at the Foundation for Defense for Democracies. Thank you for your time today. We're very grateful. And David Herzenhorn, chief Brussels correspondent for Politico Europe. We appreciate your time as well. Thank you. And Robin Wright, stay with us. We're going to be returning to more listener calls and more conversation about the Iran nuclear deal. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. You can join the conversation. Do you feel less safe than you did a day ago? Do you feel safer now that President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal? I'm talking with journalist Robin Wright, who spent decades closely following Iran. And let's talk a little bit about some reaction from Washington. Speaking to CNN yesterday afternoon, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake said the U.S. should stay in the Iran nuclear agreement, both for reasons having to do with security and diplomacy.
Our allies who have worked on this with us, we're going to need them. We're going to need to work with them for various threats to come, not just this one. And if we're not seen as a reliable partner, then we're going to have a hard time moving ahead.
And here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calling the Iran nuclear agreement a terrible deal that was flawed from the beginning.
It didn't deal with ballistic missiles. It didn't deal with their, shall I say, their extracurricular activities creating problems all across the Middle East.
And joining me now for some more perspective on this is Sahil Kapoor. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, and he joins us from Washington. Sahil, good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
We got a little taste there of some reaction from Washington, but what are you hearing on Capitol Hill? Who's coming down on what side here?
Well, it's certainly a mixed bag. A lot of it breaks down cleanly on partisan lines. Some of the president's biggest allies on Capitol Hill, including Mitch McConnell, as you played, along with Senators Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton, who have been big critics of this Iran deal, praised his decision. They support the move to withdraw. A number of Democrats overwhelmingly oppose, the decision to withdraw. They supported the Iran deal. But what's interesting here is that there are some breaks from the traditional dividing lines here. There are several Democrats who voted to disapprove the Iran deal in 2015 who now say it's a bad idea to withdraw, that now that it's in place, that the United States should give it a shot and try to fix the flaws in it rather than simply junk it and walk away. That includes Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, and Bob Menendez, the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Both of them voted against the Iran deal in 2015, do not support the president's decision. There are also Republicans who have broken ranks with the president, say now is not the time to withdraw. That includes Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, both senators who are Republicans who are retiring, Susan Collins, a moderate Republican, Ed Royce, a congressman in the House. They say the better move right now would be to enforce it, work with European partners to try to address the flaws in it, and don't just walk away from it. So there are some notable breaks here in terms of, Democrats and Republicans concerned about what's next because the president has not made that clear.
Hmm. Robin Wright, there's a big subject that I wanted to ask you about, and Sahil, I'd love to get your take on this too, and that is the people that are around Donald Trump right now. And I'm thinking of National Security Advisor John Bolton. He's known for his hawkish views on Iran. He's advocated for regime change. So I'm wondering if you think, is this a first step toward making that a reality? And if so, does that bring us closer to a hot confrontation with Iran? Robin, what are you seeing?
The day after the deal, that is the obvious big question. What actually is the Trump administration's long-term goal? I think that it has shifted with the arrival of John Bolton at the National Security Council and Mike Pompeo at the State Department. They are very different dynamics than Rex Tillerson or H.R. McMaster, because both of them, Pompeo and Bolton, have in the past, in other capacities, urged regime change, said it was the only solution to dealing with Iran. And so the question becomes, is it not just the deal that the Trump administration was addressing, but was it setting a course of action that leads to a broader confrontation or the U.S. interest or advocacy in challenging the legitimacy, the viability, the longevity of the Islamic revolutionary regime in Tehran? I've asked that question several times in White House briefings and was asked again of John Bolton in a briefing after the Trump announcement yesterday. And they all claim that they want to see a change in behavior in Iran, but not, they're not necessarily talking about regime change. But frankly, the scope of the change that's being advocated is so extensive that it kind of amounts to or sounds like a regime change. And of course, that's something where you find very few allies of any ilk with the United States, even among those who don't like the regime in Tehran.
Let's take some more callers. Will is calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Will, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Anthony. I just would like to toss out a slightly different way of looking at things that may or may not be so in terms of the relationship between Trump and the U.S. on the one hand and our European allies. It's been looked at in terms of commentary has said, well, that he's going to introduce a rift in the alliance, or that he's trying to drag them along to go with his way of approaching the deal. I want to suggest that maybe something more sophisticated is happening. Maybe we've got a arrangement between our European allies and the U.S. that's been part of the discussions over the last few months that essentially involves what's called in police work a tough cop, con cop approach, where one of them is threatening to beat up the suspect and the other is saying, no, cooperate with me. I think maybe that we've now got a situation where the EU allies can be the con cop. They're nice, they're keeping Iran in the deal, whereas Donald Trump and the USA are now the tough cop that's threatening them. And in the process, puts a squeeze on, because Iran can't walk away from this deal without blowing off the and throwing everybody into the hands of where Trump wants to be, but they're now under additional pressure. So I'd just be interested what your guests think about the notion that maybe there's more coordination between the U.S. and the European allies than appears on the surface.
Got it, Will. It's an intriguing idea. Sahil, what do you think, good cop, bad cop, between the Trump administration and its European allies?
I don't believe that to be the case. That would contradict so much of the reporting that's out there in terms of, you know, EU countries that have been strongly supportive of this Iran deal, that have been critical of President Trump's, insinuations before yesterday that he was going to pull out. There was an urging on the part of the French President, Emmanuel Macron, to President Trump, urging him to stay in the Iran deal. So there's no real indication of a good cop, bad cop strategy here. And if there was, we see a situation now where Britain, France, Germany want to stay in the deal. They don't want to renegotiate it. China and Russia are also still in it. They don't want to renegotiate it. All this happens as President Trump's new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was traveling to North Korea to kind of lay the groundwork for the big meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un. Of course, a Chinese envoy said yesterday that North Korea is watching the president's actions on Iran, and that's going to be a gauge as to whether the United States can be trusted to cut a deal and you know, stick by it in the future. So if there is a sort of conspiratorial good cop, bad cop happening here, there are obviously a lot of negative effects of that, and I'm not really sure it would work. So I tend to be very, very doubtful of that.
And Robin Wright, same question to you. Does that respond to the caller's suggestion there?
It sounds appealing, you know, in this era of kind of conspiracy theories. But I've been involved in briefings with the Europeans since January when the initiative began to try to find a compromise. I talked to a European country on the day that Boris Johnson, the British foreign minister, was in Washington Monday to make one last pitch. And the sources were off the record, so I can't identify which country, but you can figure it out. Mm-hmm. We're very clear that they tried right until the end, that there was a profound disagreement, and they couldn't come to a deal. Now, it is true that the United States will continue talking to the Europeans about how they move forward. The problem is there's this huge gap, and it's very hard to see how they move forward on a new deal or fixing the old deal when they couldn't come to agreement before this decision. They clearly have common visions in terms of the meddling in Iran, meddling in the Middle East issue, and concern about the missile program. And they may try to talk about those tangential issues or side issues, just as important as the nuclear issue. But it's clear that they don't agree on the Iran deal and probably won't for the foreseeable future.
And Anthony, if I can just add,
go ahead, Sahir.
This is part. I mean, there's a tendency, you know, an understandable tendency to search for complex explanations to phenomena that tend to have simple ones. Now, this is part of a long project on the part of President Trump to undo his predecessor Barack Obama's legacy. We saw that with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We saw that with the Paris Climate Accords, the DACA program for young undocumented people, the repeal of the health insurance mandate, the elimination of countless environmental regulations. Now, the Iran deal is the latest installment in that. And in many of these situations, especially on the international front, there has not been a clear plan, plan forward as to what comes next after this. So I think the history tells us that this is very much, you know, Donald Trump trying to undo a signature achievement of his predecessor that he campaigned strongly against on the campaign trail.
All right. Sahil Kapoor, stand by. We're going to say goodbye to Robin Wright, a contributing writer for The New Yorker and joint fellow at the Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace. Robin, we appreciate so much having you today talking about this really important development. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
And let's stick with Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. And we're going to pivot from the Iran nuclear deal to U.S. electoral politics with your help, Sahil. Yesterday, primary voters went to the polls in Ohio, West Virginia, North Carolina, and Indiana. They all went for Trump in 2016. We're going to talk about that vote yesterday. And you can find a link to Sahil's latest piece, GOP Voters Stick with Pro-Trump Candidates in Senate Primaries, at our website, onpointradio.org. So, Sahil, you write that Republicans wrapped up three crucial U.S. Senate primaries in West Virginia, Indiana, and Ohio by nominating candidates who embraced President Trump, while Democratic voters rejected insurgents from the left to stick with the party's mainstream. So let's focus on three states that Trump won in 2016. And first, let's talk about West Virginia. The GOP dodged a bullet. Voters rejected controversial coal executive Don Blankenship and embraced State Attorney General Patrick Morrissey. So he'll take on the Democratic incumbent Joe Manchin. Tell us about the significance of this race, first of all.
Well, so West Virginia was probably the most closely watched of the primaries yesterday, mainly because of this candidate, Don Blankenship, who is a former coal baron. He served jail time for mine safety violations that ended up killing 29 coal miners. He has launched inflammatory and racist attacks on Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell's wife and her parents. So this was clearly a candidate that Republican leaders in Washington doubted was viable in a general election and could, you know, blow a winnable seat in November, part of a long history of Republican voters nominating candidates for the Senate who are too radical to win general elections, like Todd Akin in Missouri, Richard Murdoch in Indiana, ironically, who led to Joe Donnelly's surprise election. So he did not win. He came in third place despite a last-minute scare where he seemed to be surging in some internal general polls. The winner of that primary was Attorney General Patrick Morrisey. He's likely to have the backing of the establishment. President Trump has been warm to him, and he is viewed as a viable candidate to take on Joe Manchin, who has been surprisingly robust politically in a state that voted for Donald Trump by 42 points in 2016.
Mm. All right. So let's look at another state that voted yesterday, Indiana, where Republican Mike Braun defeated Congressman Luke Messer and Todd Rokita. What's the takeaway from this race in which all three seemed to fight over who was more supportive of Donald Trump?
Right. The intriguing thing about this race was that it was essentially a three-way love fest for President Trump. It was a competition over who could win his affections, who would be the most robust ally of his once they get to Washington. And the winner was Mike Braun, a businessman, a former state representative. He's wealthy and self-funded. He defeated two congressmen who had been rivals really since going all the way back to college. Luke Messer and Todd Rokita, they kind of engaged in somewhat of a murder-suicide pact where they focused so much of their anger and ire and attacks on each other, and Braun kind of emerged as the winning candidate here.
Right. And so Braun will take on, will challenge Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly, right?
That's correct. He ran unopposed. Now, Manchin coasted to reelection, crushed his opponent, who was running as a kind of progressive alternative, a more liberal, senator who'd go to Washington. Joe Donnelly ran unopposed. The fascinating thing here is that we are not seeing the dynamic on the Democratic side that we saw on the Republican side in the Obama years. There's no so-called Tea Party of the left because Democratic voters in these red states are content to support conservative-leaning candidates like Joe Manchin and Joe Donnelly, even though they've supported parts of Trump's agenda.
All right. So one more state I want to talk about really quickly. In Ohio, U.S. Representative Jim Renacci won the Republican nomination for Senate to take on the Democratic incumbent Sherrod Brown. Renacci's another Republican who pledged fealty to Trump. So talk about, I guess, all three of these races and what they might portend for the midterms coming up in November. I mean, what's the pattern that sort of jumps out at you?
Correct. Well, Renacci signed a letter last week with some fellow House Republicans nominating President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. Another candidate, Evan Jenkins of the in West Virginia, who was competing for that nomination and lost, had led that letter. So that gives you a sense of how popular President Trump remains with Republican voters. Now, looking ahead to November, Renacci is seen as probably the strongest candidate. Braun and Morrisey are seen as reasonably strong candidates to take on the Democratic incumbents there. So there's no big scare in the primary side for either side where they ended up nominating radical candidates who are seen as unelectable. Sherrod Brown is favored in Ohio. That's a state that Donald Trump won by 8 points. The races in West Virginia and Indiana are classified as toss-ups. Even though they're very strongly Republican-leaning states, the climate favors Democrats, and that has to be accounted for. They're far more energized at this moment than Republicans are.
Yeah, and I guess I have a question to you about all three of these Republicans sort of pledging loyalty to Donald Trump. Is that a winning strategy in November? Very quickly, in the 10 or 15 seconds we've
got
left.
Very good question. We don't know the answer to that. It's a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, it will mobilize some voters who are loyal to President Trump and want to see him succeed in Washington. But on the other hand, it could have a greater mobilizing effect among Democrats who are mad as hell and want to install a Congress that will confront him and be more adversarial.
Remains to be seen. Shahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, thank you so much for joining us today for talking about the Iran deal and about electoral politics here in the U.S. We appreciate it.
Great to talk to you.
That's it for now. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.